dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man who has covered that war with uncommon intelligence for many years, notably as a national security reporter for The Washington Times, is the author of Rumsfeld's War and Sabotage. His name is Rowan Scarborough. Always a welcome guest here. Rowan, good to have you back. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Frank.
Well, Rowan, as I say, you've been covering the national security and foreign policy portfolio for a very long time. You've seen a lot of presidential forays overseas. You've covered quite a few of them, I believe, over the years. What did you make of Donald Trump's visit, notably to the G20 meeting and then on to Korea and, well, North Korea as well as South?
I think, Frank, for a president who supposedly is an isolationist, wants America to withdraw from certain alliances, that this is a president who very much enjoys the world stage. He likes going overseas. He likes interacting with world leaders, especially ones who he believes can do something for America. And if he sees a grand bargain that will make the world better and also help his reelection bid, that makes him even happier. And the other theme that I see every time he goes overseas is that Trump delights in going against the grain of the liberal media, the Washington Post, the New York Times, who want to set the standards for how he is supposed to conduct himself, and he refuses to do it. So they want him, when he appears with Vladimir Putin, to condemn him in person for interfering in our elections, and instead he jokes about it. I'm not sure that's the right thing to do, but he knows who that galls, and that galls the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the Democratic Party. And likewise, they want him to chastise the Saudi leader, the Saudi prince, for the assassination of the Washington Post columnist. And again, he refuses to do that. I think part of it is to anger the mainstream media, but also part of it is there's a grand strategy that sits way, way above trying to castigate foreign leaders. And that involves Iran. That involves getting a new trade deal with China. And it involves trying to get nukes out of North Korea. So I think that's the way he looks at foreign policy. A grand bargain is ahead, not necessarily a skirmish at a summit.
Yeah. Well, we'll be discussing with several of our guests in the course of this program that grand bargain, the prospects particularly for it vis-a-vis China and North Korea with Gordon Chang and Greg Scarlett-Chu. Let me ask you, though, to pick up on your point about the president sort of poking his finger in the eye of the Washington Post, the New York Times, the Democratic Party, for that matter, on the Putin matter and alleged interference in American elections. The president, of course, quipped on the occasion of when he was being urged to talk with Putin about this. Vladimir, don't interfere in our elections, kind of wagging his finger at him and, as you say, making somewhat of a mockery of the whole thing. This has sent the Democrats once again into paroxysms of fury over the need for an impeachment of the president. Again, you're following that story closely, too, and I wanted to get an update from you, Rowan Scarborough, on how it appears this campaign is going in the House of Representatives at the moment. We've had Hope Hicks testifying, among others, about the president and what she saw in the course of the campaign that might bear on obstruction of justice. We've got Bob Mueller's testimony coming up at the end of the middle of the month, July 17th. Highly anticipated testimony at that about what his investigation found. Give us sort of your sense of the lay of the land.
Sure. I think Democrats right now are woefully short of a majority that they would need to impeach the president. Because Speaker Pelosi does not want to do it. She doesn't think that's the way to retain the majority in the House. And so the Democrats are heeding her guidance. And I don't think there are 50 votes right now to impeach. So how is the White House responding? They're refusing to let any of their former staffers or staffers testify as to what was said inside the White House in the last 2.5 years. So if they win that battle, which is going to go to court, a judge is going to rule, and maybe an appeals court is going to rule, that will leave Chairman Nadler in a horrible position to compile the kind of evidence that he would need to get the House to go along with him. What is striking about the first witness to appear before Nadler in a closed session, Hope Hicks, is that they're still pursuing volume one of the Mueller report, you know, the conspiracy that he didn't find. And they continue to ask for the same questions about how many Russian contacts were there? What did this person say? What does that person say? Why did you answer this email from someone who might have been a Russian? Just they can't let go of something that 40 FBI agents in the CIA intelligence community and Mr. Mueller and his Democratic prosecutors could not find. And I don't think in the end that's going to help Democrats either, because when you continue to beat a dead horse like that, you turn the voters off. The voters, the majority polls show a majority of voters want to leave Russia behind. A majority of voters don't want impeachment. So it's difficult to see how Adam Schiff and Chairman Nadler are going to overcome this in the end.
Well, I guess the question is that really their purpose, or is it just sort of trying to keep their base happy and sort of demonstrate that they really, really, really want to impeach the president, and if they fall short, it's not for want of trying. It sounds awfully cynical, but when you're dealing with people like Adam Schiff, cynicism is warranted, it seems to be.
You've nailed it, Frank. The big millionaire and billionaire donors want impeachment. And they spread money all over the left-wing movement in this country. And Nadler and Schiff has to keep them happy. And, of course, they're also looking behind them to see if there are any primary challenges. You know, AOC has built up a sizable war chest. She challenged an incumbent in a Democratic primary in the Bronx, where about 20% of voters come out. And they said Nadler is in the same city, right? Schiff is in a very liberal district out in and around Hollywood, and they don't want a primary challenger, a social Democrat, coming after them. So, as you say, they have to feed the beast, which is the very, very strident left wing.
Yeah. And do you anticipate Mueller will be less reticent than he has promised to be, having said he's just going to stick to his report? That's all they're going to get out of him?
You know, it's sort of a dichotomy here. There are questions that pertain to conflict, obstruction of justice, and Trump-Russia, which pertain exactly to the report. And I think he is going to hold to that line. I think he's going to hold the line that, as I said in the report.
These are fascinating subjects, and we will be watching them closely, as I know will you, Rowan Scarborough at The Washington Times. We'll look forward to talking with you further about them as these hearings play out. Thank you for the great work you do there. Come back to us again very soon.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back, joined each week, I'm very pleased to say, by Gordon Chang, and we have that privilege this moment. Gordon, of course, is a very accomplished pundit, commentator, author, analyst, and all-around guru on matters involving Asia, and specifically Communist China. And we're anxious to pick his brains about what on earth went down over this weekend on the margins and after the G20 meeting. Gordon, it's good to have you back. Welcome. Thank you for joining us as always.
Oh, well, thank you so much, Frank.
So let's start with President Trump's meeting with Xi Jinping, the dictator for life of Communist China. The president came out of the meeting and held a press conference in which he revealed some of what the two men had agreed upon. You, among others, have expressed concern, as have I and the Committee on the Present Danger China, about one particular commitment the president made, and that was to continue selling American parts and other equipment to Huawei, the Chinese communications conglomerate that the president himself has described as a foreign adversary and its operations as a national emergency. What are we to make of that commitment, and where do you think it's likely to go from here?
Yeah, this is an extremely critical matter, Frank. President Trump, at his Osaka G20 press conference, said that the United States was going to relax the ban on the sale of products and services to Huawei, as well as licensing of technology to Huawei. This is a critical matter because Huawei poses a threat to not only American national security, but also the national security of our partners and friends. And this is an echo of what President Trump did in May of last year when he gave a similar reprieve to ZTE, another Chinese telecom equipment manufacturer. In 2018, Trump said that he gave the reprieve to ZTE as a quote-unquote personal favor to Chinese leader Xi Jinping. This time, it's much more disturbing, Frank, because this time, in the run-up to the Osaka G20, Xi Jinping issued a public demand to the United States that we grant the reprieve. And he did this through several of his officials. So what happened at the G20 was that President Trump complied with the Chinese demand, which was public. So you can draw your own conclusions as to what happened. But nonetheless, essentially, China is now running American national security.
Well, I don't think the final word has been heard on this one. Larry Kudlow was on the Sunday shows clarifying what the president meant and made it clear, as the president did himself in that press conference, that anything that had to do with the national emergency wouldn't be permitted to be sold. Well, our view of this is, and I think yours, Gordon, anything that we use to help Huawei under these circumstances is a national emergency and would be furthering their capabilities to threaten us. So Marco Rubio, I believe, is going to be offering legislation to preclude this, and I wouldn't be surprised if it doesn't go blistering through the Congress on a bipartisan and veto-proof basis. We'll be watching it closely. More generally, Gordon, the president seems to be re-engaging with the Chinese on the trade negotiations. Your quick thoughts on that?
Yes, President Trump said that he would not be imposing additional Section 301 tariffs on about $325 billion worth of Chinese goods. In other words, the remainder of Chinese goods. This was because they were restarting trade talks. This is, I think, an unwelcome development. But nonetheless, the Chinese are going to make it difficult to come to any sort of trade agreement. So I don't see this as serious as the reprieve for Huawei. You know, with regard to trade talks, the Chinese are not in a position to deal with the international community or with the United States in good faith. That's why Xi Jinping withdrew commitments that his trade negotiators made to the United States. And he did that across the board. And we learned about that in early May. That indicates real problems in the Chinese political system, which means that the markets may love this whole idea that we're going to restart trade talks. But again, we're going to reach another impasse. And I think that essentially we are going to see the president do a number of things, including imposing additional tariffs. And I think he's going to reconsider this reprieve for Huawei because he's going to, I think, understand the dimensions of what he did, as well as there's going to be a lot of pressure from not only national security types, but everybody else across the American political spectrum.
It really seems as though it's struck a chord there. Huawei's true character has been more broadly understood than I had imagined. Also, I just have to say, Gordon, that the one tangible concession the president pointed to that came out of the Chinese was that they were going to buy more agricultural products. One of our colleagues, Kyle Bass, has pointed out recently in an article in the Daily Caller that the Chinese are suffering massive difficulties with their food supply as a result of avian swine flu on the one hand and the so-called army worm on the other, affecting the pig population and the production of cereal grains, respectively. Gordon, how serious is that problem as you see it? And do we anticipate that this is a concession that the Chinese were actually compelled to make rather than something that was a real quid pro quo?
Yeah, China needs to buy food. There is the African swine flu, which, as serious as it is, covering most of China. There is a report that doubled the number of pigs reported were actually infected with this. And this decimation of an important meat for Chinese consumers. I think China would have to buy food from somewhere. So this is not an important concession that the Chinese were making to President Trump. I'm very happy that they're going to be buying American food and primary products. But we got to remember that this whole issue of what people call the trade war is about the Chinese theft of U.S. intellectual property, hundreds of billions of dollars a year. And we cannot be compromising what we're going to do to protect our IP in order to sell primary products. We do not want to end up with an economy which resembles that of the third world. And in terms of our relationships with China, that's what's happening. Frank, we're buying manufactured goods from China and we're selling them primary products out of the ground. This is not good for us.
Yeah. You know, Gordon, we had a Committee on the Present Danger China threat briefing and discussion in Chicago 2 weeks ago. And one of the upshots of that was reports from the electronics manufacturing sector that well over a million jobs had been lost just in that sector alone as a result of some of the Chinese predatory practices, intellectual property theft, and simple, you know, dumping of products and the like. And I'm struck by the fact that President Trump felt moved by Xi Jinping saying that 85,000 jobs in China would be affected if he didn't get relief from this prohibition on Huawei. Also, Gordon, I just have to say, and we got more to talk about here quickly, but I did want to just also note that the president's comment that they'll be discussing Huawei at the end of the trade negotiations is a little unsettling, too. It's not entirely clear what he means, but it sounds as though it's on the bargaining table, just not at the moment. Is that how you read it?
Yeah. Yeah. Huawei is a national security matter. Yeah. We should not be bargaining it away for, you know, selling agricultural products or whatever. And remember, we're trying to get our allies and partners not to install Huawei 5G equipment. That's the fifth generation of wireless communications, the Internet of Things. Well, how are they going to look at this? They're going to say, you know, do you Americans, is this a national security issue or is this a bargaining chip for the United States to sell more stuff to China? So this undercuts a critical initiative that we have. And there is nothing good that can come out of President Trump's comments on Huawei or his negotiating away American national security. We got to be clear what he's doing. I mean, we wouldn't tolerate this from any other president. We should not be tolerating this from Trump.
Well, I'm very hopeful that this was going to be fixed because I think it is untenable and ill-advised. Gordon, quickly, Hong Kong is once again in the throes of a huge demonstration, some of which has turned violent on the occasion of the anniversary of the, well, what I think of as the surrender of Hong Kong by Britain to communist China. Give us your sense of what's happening there now and where this is likely to go.
We'll probably see more violent clashes going forward. Frank, we've got to remember that the protesters in Hong Kong have learned a valuable lesson. On June 9th, they had a million people in the streets, and the Hong Kong government would not give way on the extradition bill or anything else. So on June 12th, there were violent clashes at the Legislative Council building. And then after that, Hong Kong's chief executive, Carrie Lam, gave way. You put 2 million people on the streets on June 16th, and the government, after a peaceful demonstration, didn't do anything. So basically, you know, kids in Hong Kong now understand that violence is the only way to protect their society. That's an unfortunate lesson, but Beijing has taught that to the people of Hong Kong.
Yeah. Well, there will be likely more violence, I'm afraid, next at the hands of the People's Republic of China. Now that the G20 meeting is behind them, I'm afraid that it may well happen soon, too. Gordon, let me turn quickly to one last item. You, of course, have written, in addition to The Coming Collapse of China and Losing South Korea, terrific book, Nuclear Showdown, North Korea Takes on the World. Your quick thoughts on President Trump's handshake and short excursion into North Korea yesterday.
Historic. What this shows is that President Trump can change the narrative. He can get other leaders to do things that they never thought that they would do. And he can do all of that on short notice. You know, whether this furthers denuclearization, we're only going to learn later. But yesterday we saw a reconciliation of North Korea and the United States. And, you know, one day President Trump had a great triumph. Whether this means something in the long term, as I said, we'll learn. But nonetheless, it was a very interesting spectacle.
It certainly was. We'll be talking more with Greg Scarlatou next about the implications of it substantively as it relates particularly to propping up and legitimating the North Korean regime. Gordon Chang, thank you for your time today. As always, the great work you do at Fox News and, of course, at the Daily Beast, thank you for joining us from time to time as well. We'll talk with you again next week. Next up, as promised, Greg Scarlatou, an expert on North Korea, straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. I'm very pleased to say we're joined by Greg Scarlatou, who is, among other things, the executive director of the Committee for Human Rights in North Korea. He teaches at Hankuk University's School of Foreign Studies in Seoul. He is also an instructor at the U.S. State Department's Foreign Service Institute on matters involving Korea and Japan, and Vice President of the Executive Board of the International Council on Korean Studies. He's very active in helping illuminate what is in fact going on in North Korea as best one can, and the stakes involved in understanding or failing to understand accurately the ground truth there. Greg Scarlatou, it's so good to have you back. Thank you for taking the time on what I imagine is a very busy day after President Trump wandered across the border into North Korea and shook the hand of Kim Jong-un there.
Always a pleasure to be on your program, Frank.
Thank you. Well, let's talk a little bit about that handshake. It has been widely portrayed as historic and very much a testament to the showmanship of Donald Trump and the interest in participating in such showmanship of the dictator of North Korea. What was your take on it?
Well, diplomacy is not a bad thing. Of course, you have been engaged in diplomacy with North Korea for 30 years. President Trump has employed a new tool, the summit diplomacy. We've seen three meetings between President Trump and Kim Jong-un. We've seen quite a few handshakes. Again, on the upside, nothing wrong with handshakes if they diffuse tension. But what hasn't changed is that the fundamental nature of the Kim regime. We have no evidence so far that the Kim regime is willing to abandon its nuclear weapons or long-range ballistic missiles. Personal diplomacy, charismatic diplomacy, summer diplomacy is not a bad thing, but really, in order to see some progress on the nuclear and missile front, it is high time we saw a declaration of capabilities, both in terms of sites where these weapons are produced and the number of nuclear weapons currently in possession of the Kim regime. Of course, they will distort the numbers and lie about it, but that would be a good starting point. We have seen none of that yet, unfortunately. And all we have seen is Kim Jong-un continuing to very stubbornly pursue the same fundamental strategic objectives as the father and the grandfather, the survival of the Kim regime. Of course, there's only one competitor outside the borders of North Korea, only one competitor, and that is South Korea. And as preposterous as that might sound, the Kim regime has not given up on establishing hegemony over the entire Korean Peninsula as the only way to ensure its own long-term survival.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you about that, because obviously President Trump spent some time with Kim, but he also spent considerable time with Moon Jae-in, the president of South Korea. When you say it sounds outlandish, unfortunately, it seems as though the Moon government in South Korea is approximately as interested in reunification with the North, even on the North's terms, as is Kim Jong-un. Walk us through that, if you would, please.
There is deep concern within many of the people and citizens of South Korea that the South Korean government under President Moon Jae-in has lowered its defenses, has made too many unilateral concessions to North Korea, and has quite frankly been rendered irrelevant. Please do not take this as a political statement of support for one political party or another in South Korea. But only a few years ago, South Korea was a regional and global leader dispatching peacekeepers to troubled areas, disbursing humanitarian and development assistance to countries all over the developing world. Now, the U.S. president visits South Korea. There are so many important issues: maintaining a strong U.S.-South Korea alliance, dealing with the tensions along the trade relationship, and so on and so forth. And the big news is that President Trump shook hands with Kim Jong-un in the DMZ. It almost feels as if South Korea has been rendered somehow irrelevant. The whole point, I would argue, is to remember that the only way to bring peace, prosperity, stability, eventually unification to Koreans living in the South and in the North is unification under a free, democratic, prosperous Republic of Korea. I have to say, Frank, that I was very heartened when the president, for example, gave that speech before the South Korean National Assembly in November 2017, emphasizing the importance of bringing human rights and freedom to the people of North Korea. He invited a disabled North Korean activist, Chi Sung-ho, to the State of the Union address, met with a group of eight North Koreans in the Oval Office. But all of this stopped after the Pyeongchang Olympics. Human rights has disappeared from the agenda. We see, for example, our special representative for North Korea policy, Steve Biegun, having met on multiple occasions with humanitarian aid organizations that argue more or less unconditional aid to North Korea, but we've seen no meetings with human rights organizations. The big problem with North Korea is, of course, trust. We're talking about verification, but really there is absolutely no trust. We don't trust them for very good reasons, because they've breached each and every international agreement they've had. They don't trust us. For that reason, it's really difficult, nearly impossible, to add a new issue to the agenda later on. I absolutely do not buy into the argument that it's okay, we'll get close, and perhaps we'll, after the establishment of diplomatic relations, we'll see progress on the human rights front. I absolutely fundamentally disagree with that viewpoint. What the regime wants is legitimacy, recognition as a nuclear weapon state. We have to remember that despite handshakes, Kim Jong-un sits at the top of a regime that commits crimes against humanity.
Yeah, he sure does. So this is a very troubling perspective, Greg Scarlett-Dube. Just make the case, if you would, for why human rights should be in the mix here. Isn't it enough that we achieve, potentially, the denuclearization of North Korea? Should we care? And I'm asking this rhetorically, to be honest, but nonetheless, should we care that the Kim dynasty continues to oppress its own people? The president has talked about, you know, making them rich and thereby presumably lifting all boats. But why should human rights be front and center in these conversations as you see it?
Frank, we must understand that brutality, oppression, repression, political prison camps, crimes against humanity, torture, deliberate starvation, forced labor, these are at the very core. These are the distinctive features of the regime. A manifestation of the nature of the regime is, of course, its weapons programs that we focus on. But in order to find a long-term solution, we must focus on the nature of the regime. Of course, we see promises of economic development being extended to the regime of Kim Jong-un. How can one run a water and sanitation project next to a political prison camp? How can any Western or Korean or Japanese company invest in a country that is committing crimes against humanity? We will not just stand by civil society organizations trying to protect the rights of the people of North Korea, trying to bring human rights and freedom to that country. It will be simply impossible. Of course, denuclearization, a full, final, verifiable denuclearization, the dismantlement of the ballistic missile program will be fundamental conditions in order to have any semblance of development in North Korea. But what they really need is comprehensive economic, social, political reform. And first and foremost, they need to get rid of political prison camps, other unlawful detention facilities, allow international organizations, international NGOs in, allow them access to secure the safe resettlement of the prisoners. That would be a great starting point, even in order to build trust.
Yeah. Greg, let me ask you one other quick question very quickly. Communist China, of course, was also on the dance card of President Trump during this trip to the G20. He met with the president for life, the dictator of China, Xi Jinping. Do you think that the issue of China's role in perpetuating this nuclear and other threat from the North Koreans came up? And is it possible to deal with the North Korean threat without China abandoning the enabling that it has done to this point of the North?
Frank, I don't know if this issue came up this particular time. China's fundamental strategic stance on North Korea has not changed. They still regard them as a buffer zone, a bargaining chip, a vassal state. They're not always happy with the Kim regime of North Korea. But on the other hand, they continue to provide much needed protection. I run into this problem at the UN and other international organizations all the time. China most likely does not have the capability to transform North Korea, but it surely has the capability to shut down North Korea. However, because North Korea creates such big issues for us, the United States, because they're such a big thorn in the side of the United States and the threat to our allies in South Korea and Japan in particular, yes, China continues to contribute to perpetuating this regime.
We will be discussing it further on this program, you can be sure. Greg Scarlett, thank you so much for the work you do at the Committee for Human Rights in North Korea. And I hope you'll come back to us again very soon.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. It's a delight to say we're joined by one of my favorite people. Her name is Rosemary Jenks. She is the Director for Government Relations at the simply indispensable grassroots organization Numbers USA. Rosemary is a force of nature, particularly when it comes to defending our country from those who would destroy what's left of our immigration system or otherwise facilitate the adoption of open borders, something that seems very much to be on the minds of those who would be candidates for the Democratic presidential nomination. Rosemary, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. It's so good to catch you. I understand we're breaking into your vacation time, and I'm very grateful for that especially.
I'm always happy to join you, Frank.
Thank you. Well, listen, I guess what I was interested most immediately is your reaction to what we heard over two nights in the Democratic presidential debates among the 20-some individuals seeking their party's nomination. It seemed to most of us to have been kind of a full-throated endorsement of open borders, virtually without exception. Is that how you saw it?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right on that, Frank. The candidates are rushing to the, not even the left, but the crazy, quite frankly, because, you know, they're talking about decriminalizing illegal entry, which means open borders. If you're not going to penalize people for coming here illegally, they're going to come. And of course, they're talking about health care for illegal aliens and, you know, all the benefits of U.S. citizenship for people who broke the law getting here. I think this is pretty far out of the mainstream of America. And I really hope that people are paying attention to this because, you know, this is critical. And if you look at just what President Obama did in terms of encouraging illegal immigration through DACA, and DACA is the reason that we have this border surge right now, you know, a president can do extraordinary damage without the help of Congress. And if there's a Democratic Congress with a Democratic president, one of these candidates, our country's in real danger.
Katie barred the door. Yeah, well, it may be that there really is simply but no country after that, because with the surge of population that would be migrating here from elsewhere, it's hard to say what would be left of our constitutional republic. But just to pick up on a couple of the things you talked about there, first of all, let's decrypt DACA, Rosemary Jenks. What is that? What would it be in the present environment? And why is it the catalyst for much of the families that were described as coming here in huge numbers at the moment?
So DACA was President Obama's illegal, unconstitutional amnesty for people, illegal aliens who supposedly were brought here by their parents at a young age. And he decided unilaterally, because Congress had failed several times to pass what they call the DREAM Act, he decided unilaterally to give them amnesty and a work permit so they could stay here. As soon as the message went out that minors were basically out of bounds of law enforcement, minors started coming. They started first in 2014 as the unaccompanied alien surge. And then the family members discovered that if they brought a child with them, the adult, if they brought a child with them, they too would be out of bounds of law enforcement. So the unaccompanied alien minor surge turned into this family unit surge that we're seeing today, where you actually have cartels renting and recycling children to get adults across illegally and to ensure that they'll be released into our communities.
Could you explain how this works? Because I get that they are bringing people in with children who may have no relationship to them. How do they get the kids back for the purposes of recycling them once they've come into the United States?
They'll just take them to a designated point at the border, and a cartel employee will pick them up and bring them back to the other side. This is what happens when you have open borders.
So, Rosemary, you mentioned healthcare. The idea that we would be providing free, comprehensive healthcare for anyone who manages to get into this country, even if they do so illegally, would seem to be palpably a magnet for more people to come here. How do the Democrats justify this in terms of, well, any kind of budgetary constraint or the concern about having created a vehicle for bringing people who wish to do us harm, as well as people who may simply be seeking employment opportunities into this country on the strength of that magnetic effect?
They generally don't justify it in terms of budgetary matters. They generally just ignore that it will be a massive burden on taxpayers and a massive magnet for additional illegal immigration. And we can sort of see the beginnings of this happening right now, where we have a huge number of sick people coming to the border and crossing over, knowing that we're going to provide them with at least emergency medical care. You know, you've got people who have contagious diseases. You've got people who have things like cirrhosis, and we're treating them. And that message has gone out already, and they're coming in increasing numbers. So we're already seeing what this burden is going to be. And remember, we just passed a $4.5 billion supplemental to pay for those costs. This is going to be an ongoing cost, let alone the cost of the national security problems that we could potentially face if dangerous people are coming across. And by dangerous, I mean like terrorists, not just dangerous in terms of contagious diseases.
Yeah. On the contagious diseases issue, I have the feeling that not nearly enough attention is being paid to the public health implications of all of this. Some of these people are coming in without vaccinations, even if they don't manifest the symptoms of contagious diseases at the moment. They could well be carrying them. And to the extent that they're going into our schools or they're going into the communities across this country, is there any concern being expressed by, well, Democrats most immediately, or for that matter, anybody else, Rosemary Jenks, about what this might portend, not just for, you know, our emergency rooms, but for the American people and their children more generally?
There have been none of the Democrats. I haven't heard any Democrats say a single thing about this, but certainly the Border Patrol, which is being exposed to all of these diseases, is extremely concerned and has been talking about it. But of course, the mainstream media doesn't want to cover this. We have aliens in quarantine right now, from what I'm told, with unknown diseases. Like, the doctors can't even figure out what the disease is. The CDC is there trying to assist. They don't know what the disease is. So the potential for epidemic or a pandemic is extraordinary.
And we are not paying attention. Rosemary, let me ask you about one other piece of this, and that is that President Trump has, of course, announced his intention to remove some of these people from the United States on the basis that they have been found by courts to be here illegally and require deportation. He postponed it at Nancy Pelosi's request, evidently, but seems to be signaling that, no kidding, he's going to begin with this practice sometime in the next week or so. How is that likely to play out? We're hearing that some law enforcement agencies like the, I believe, LAPD and the Chicago Police Department are not going to cooperate. How do you see this unfolding?
Well, you know, this is the job of Immigration and Customs Enforcement, to locate illegal aliens who have been ordered removed and to remove them. So they don't actually need, I mean, it would be nice to have the cooperation of local police departments, but they don't actually need it. You know, they've got teams that have been doing these removals all along. You know, we just don't hear about them until the president tweets about, you know, doing it on a much grander scale. But it is kind of astonishing that the media and the Democrats and even some Republicans get worked up when the president announces that he's actually going to enforce the law.
It's high time we do it. And I hope in some way, if it does get underway, Rosemary Jenks, that it will cause a much more focused and thoughtful debate about what needs to be done here to protect us and our people against the effects of untold numbers of people coming and doing so with probably, in some cases at least, malign intent. Your work in this regard and your leadership in trying to protect us against these things is indispensable. Thank you so much for joining us from time to time, Rosemary Jenks, especially for taking time from vacation to do so. We'll talk with you again soon. I hope we'll talk with the rest of you again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.